Guardian Unlimited.
Hello, I'm Nick Watt, and welcome to Politics Weekly. Well, it's Parliament's last full week before the Christmas holidays, but there's no let-up for our political leaders. The Home Secretary, Jackie Smith, faced calls to resign on Wednesday after she decided to stagger a pay rise for the police. Gordon Brown, who rallied to her defence, spent most of the week on an aeroplane as he travelled to Iraq and Afghanistan before ending up in Brussels via Lisbon. What an exciting final destination for him. On this week's show, we'll be looking at the fruits of Brown's globetrotting.
I can announce today, fully funded from the reserve, 150 new protected patrol vehicles, specially procured for Afghanistan.
That was Gordon Brown addressing MPs on Wednesday about Britain's commitment to Afghanistan. We'll be asking whether Britain is on the right track. Also on this week's show...
We will make our country the best place in the world for children to grow up.
We'll be taking a look at the government's children's plan and its author Ed Balls, the school secretary, who is seen by many as the real power behind the Brown throne. And finally, we have dusted down the Guardian's Union Jack as we prepare to join the great debate about the future of the United Kingdom. This is Politics Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. For this week's show, I'm joined by three giants from the Westminster jungle. We have Nick Gibb, the Shadow Education Minister, who is Conservative MP for the town made famous by George V, who reportedly said "bugger Bognor" on his deathbed. We have The Guardian's chief leader writer, Julian Glover. And last, but by no means least, we have The Guardian's commentator, Polly Toynbee. A quick question for all of you. We'll be talking about the future of the UK later on. Is it time to redesign the Union Jack? Nick?
I think George V would turn in his grave if they redesigned the Union Jack. You've got to keep these flags the same. You can't keep changing them every few years.
Polly?
I'm quite Welsh, so maybe we could put a dragon in the corner, but it probably isn't worth the row. I think I'd save my political capital to fight on more important questions than that.
Julian?
We might not have a choice if Alex Salmond does any more successful work in Scotland.
So has Gordon Brown finally come up with his vision for Britain? This week, his chief lieutenant, Ed Balls, tried to show the government is brimming with ideas for the future when he outlined his children's plan.
While there are many more opportunities for young people today than ever before, families do want more help to manage the new pressures they face, to balance work and family life, to deal with the internet and modern commercialism, to let children play while staying safe. And this children's plan is our response.
The government says it's taking a holistic approach as it looks at all aspects of a child's development and not just schooling. So there are plans for nursery care for two-year-olds targeted at the poorest, £225 million for new playgrounds to end what is called the no ball games culture. Ha ha ha. More contact between schools and parents and mentors for every child. Julian, do you think that at last we're seeing the Brown philosophy? And if we are seeing it, will anyone take any notice when we have the Police Federation calling on the Home Secretary to resign?
I think we definitely are. This really was one of the first big statements of the Brown government rather than a bit of Blair policy that was left over. Whether it gets noticed at the pre-Christmas week, I'm not sure. It clearly was brought out now partly in order to distract attention from an awful month. But I think it really is something the government's been working on. It's pretty solid. Whether it does the business, I don't know. We'll have to wait and see, but I'm sure they're serious about it.
Now, Polly, can I just ask you, how much do you think the children's plan will address one issue that I know you think is really, really important, and that's child poverty?
I think it will a great deal. It follows on from the Every Child Matters idea. The whole purpose of this department, of pulling it together, giving it a new name, no longer just a department for education, but children, families, as well as schools, is to try and take children in the round. And that means particularly reaching out to children who may fail before they even get to school, for whom it's too late by the time they're five, and to try to support them before they're five, starting when they're two, and keep that going all the way through school, making schools wrap around every aspect of their lives, trying to draw their parents in, because we know that getting parents involved is absolutely crucial to getting children to feel that school is for them.
Now, Nick, as Shadow Education Minister, we know that you're very committed to schools, because I think I'm right in spending that every Monday you go and visit a new school. But can we say that the Conservatives are really committed when what the biggest announcement you had this autumn was cutting inheritance tax? Shouldn't that money be going to schools?
No, we're committed to continued growth in spending on education. So education is sacrosanct so far as spending is concerned. But I'm concerned about this children's plan. I mean, we support some of the things that, that Polly's been talking about, extending childcare to two-year-olds, although the plan only extends it for 20,000 children. But I worry about phrases such as Polly just said of wrap around every aspect of a child's life when the government can't yet get even the schools right. We have Ofsted saying that 49% of secondary schools are not good enough. And even on Wednesday, Christine Gilbert was giving evidence again, saying we just have inadequate schools. Let's get the schools right, first of all. Let's get children reading by the time they leave primary school. We have 40%, 4 out of 10 children leaving primary school, not having grasped the basics in English, maths and science. And if you want to cure poverty in this country, education is the key to it. And we have a serious problem in the quality of some of our schools.
So, Polly, get the schools right.
But those things are completely, absolutely inextricably linked. That the reason why lots of children don't read properly at 11 is because they haven't cottoned on to the whole thing at the age of five. It's because of the deprivation, because of the poverty, because their parents themselves were alienated from schools. Lots of them may have deeply depressed or drug addicted or sick parents and are just not connected. And every year that passes in school, their attainment falls further behind every other child. The social gap gets wider between poor children and the rest. So that just to say, just concentrate on reading misses the point, because you need to remove all the obstacles that are making school so difficult for them. And by bringing in the whole social care, by trying to bring in the family at the earliest possible stage, you might have a chance of doing that better.
Well, I agree with that. And I think there is a case for targeting help for that small minority of children who face those who've come from those difficult backgrounds. Absolutely agree with you there, Polly. But we're talking about a much, much bigger problem. And I've talked to people who know about teaching children to read, and they say to me they can take a child from any background and have that child reading within a couple of months if they use, you know, the traditional tried and tested method of synthetic phonics. And I know I do go on about this issue a lot, but it's so important. If you can get children to read in the first 2 years of primary school, they will then go on to achieve much greater things in school later on, and it will break this cycle.
The Every Child a Reader program is going to do that, and it is synthetic phonics, and it takes out every child that's not succeeded after its first year. And I've watched this. They get 35 weeks of intensive one-to-one every day, and it makes an incredible difference. It was a system promoted by KPMG in the beginning, and it's brilliant. And now we've been promised that the children falling behind will get that.
I think this announcement's a really key test of the sort of Brown agenda. It's a test of the department too, which has been created to bring in this idea of children, which is to lift the vision, lift the destiny, talk about the very long-term, huge targets. 2020 is the figure that always comes up, the year that's going to deliver the change. The public, really, I have to say, I wonder whether they're going to wait for 2020 and whether they've got any faith in government anymore after 10 years in which they've been promised all sorts of schemes about change, lots of detail, and they really don't see huge improvements. Will they wait again? And Gordon Brown's task and Ed Balls' task is to convince the public that this time their vision is even greater and their skill is greater and their focus is going to deliver this. Well, we'll have to wait and see, because you saw Ed Balls yesterday, as well as doing education. He was busy talking about Northern Rock. He was doing all sorts of other things too. And if he's getting his fingers mixed in lots of policy, I wonder whether the focus is there. The danger is the vision's just too big.
Great. Well, education, clearly a passionate matter. Now, Ed Balls is much more than the school secretary. He's also one of the key brains behind the Brown operation. We asked Michael White, the Guardian's senior political commentator, to sum him up for us.
He has aspects of his character which Gordon Brown lacks, and if I had to sum them up in one word, it would be confidence. He's intellectually self-confident. I think Mr. Brown is full of doubt, and we keep reading he spends a huge amount of time holding the Prime Minister's hand. It's a rare example of a creche where the kids seem to be looking after the parents. How much power does Ed Balls have in government? Well, this week we've seen the children's plan, which has his fingerprints all over it. Strikes me as a bit sort of detailed, a bit overambitious, a bit interventionist, very New Labour, in other words. So that reflects a lot of power. But equally, among MPs and even fellow ministers, Mr. Balls and Ed Miliband and Douglas Alexander, they say these guys have had it too easy. They had cushy jobs as special advisers in opposition, they were parachuted into powerful positions, and they've never suffered the hard sweat of years of opposition, and they're not experienced enough to be having the kind of influence they have on Gordon Brown. But he's driven and an ambitious man. What would he like to be? Of course, he'd like to be Prime Minister. That's blindingly obvious. And the question is, does he have the retail political skills to be charming to the public, to be persuasive to MPs, to be a leader? To inherit that role, the only recent evidence I can offer is that I saw him at Number 11's charity party last week playing Father Christmas. He was quite a good Father Christmas, I have to say.
That was Michael White. So, Julian, Ed Balls is a cuddly Father Christmas. But is it healthy to have a figure who in public is in charge of our schools, but behind the scenes does so much more?
I don't think there's a problem with it if you think schools matter. Having somebody with access to the Prime Minister is fine. Ministers have always had other things to do. They've never been completely full-time. But there is a difficulty, I think, when somebody becomes powerful in a government, other ministers, other MPs, other parties begin to target them, begin to resent them, begin to mutter about them. The press start watching what they're doing. It's a dangerous position for anyone to be in. Favourites of prime ministers often fall in government. Margaret Thatcher got through a whole succession. Gordon Brown might too. I mean, remember Tony Blair? He used to have all sorts of people around him who were briefly the right-hand man, the enforcer, all sorts of things like that. They didn't last that long. So if I was Ed Balls, I'd be a bit worried about it, and I'd be trying to distance myself from Gordon Brown in public, if not in private.
Now, Nick Gibb, the Shadow Education Minister, I have a very, very hard question for you. Are you a fan of Ed Balls, the Education Secretary?
Well, I'm not sure, really. I mean, I'm waiting to see how he performs in his role. But the problem with him is that I get the impression he's not that interested in education. This, as with his predecessor, Alan Johnson, this is a stepping stone to greater things. And one of the things I've noticed about the children's plan is that it is full of education establishment long-term plans, and his proposals on testing to sort of get rid of the high-stakes test at 11 and replace it with a series of tests throughout a child's education is part of what the education establishment have been wanting to do ever since testing was introduced. So I suspect, you know, spreading thinly as he does in all these other fields and being Gordon Brown's right-hand man still, I think we'll see that he is not focusing on trying to raise standards in education in the way that he really should be.
Now, Polly, I know that you thought that Tony Blair sort of hung on a little too long and you were quite keen for the Labour succession to get on and for Gordon Brown to become Prime Minister. Are you worried that relatively young people like Ed Balls seem to wield such power behind the scenes?
I think it's a danger, but if I was going to choose one cabinet minister to be the person that did have a lot of power for a Labour government, I would choose that person to be the one in charge of children and families, because I think that really is at the heart of what most Labour people want to do, their vision of the future, their vision of what the party should really be about. And so if it pushes those policies to the front...
And Ed Balls is the right man?
I think he is. I think he's always had a passionate commitment for everything to do with children, not just because he's got a lot of small children himself, but I think he's always seen that as Labour's programme, Labour's mark, what it should be judged by in the end. You know, maybe the judgment will be harsh, but I think that's where he thinks it should be.
Great. Well, fans or enemies of Ed Balls can find out more about him and his children's plan at guardian.co.uk. Coming up on Politics Weekly, we'll be discussing the future of the United Kingdom. But first, Gordon Brown became the first serving British Prime Minister since Churchill to come within range of a real battle when he visited British troops in Helmand Province in Afghanistan on Monday. That followed a trip to Iraq on Sunday. The Guardian's intrepid political correspondent Tania Branigan donned her military boots to follow the Prime Minister, as she told Francesca Panetta.
It was really a lightning tour of both Iraq and Afghanistan for security reasons. PM's people are very keen to get him in and out of the countries as quickly as possible, really. But it meant that within 44 hours, we'd been to Basra, we'd been to Camp Bastion, which is in Helmand province, one of the British bases there, very near to Musa Qala, and also then on up to Kabul, where he met Hamid Karzai.
And how does Gordon Brown deal with these kind of trips?
Well, it's a very different style to Tony Blair. I mean, Tony Blair, you'd always sort of see him in the rolled-up shirt sleeves and the khakis sort of striding through the desert somewhere. And Gordon Brown sort of turns upon the ground in a suit and tie, looking very much like a figure of authority, I suppose. It's always slightly strange because you don't know how they'll go down with the soldiers. I don't think he got the rapturous reception that Blair initially perhaps got from troops, but equally he seemed to be rather more popular than perhaps Tony Blair was in the later stages of his premiership.
The Guardian's reporter Tania Branigan. Well, on Wednesday, the Prime Minister made a statement to MPs about Afghanistan. He indicated that Britain is in for the long haul.
This long-term comprehensive framework entails, first, more Afghan ownership, Afghan army, police and government building on NATO military achievements and taking over more responsibility for their own security. Secondly, we support localisation and then reconciliation. Afghans building on the creation of a democratic constitution by developing and strengthening their institutions, not just at national but at provincial and local level, as we support that search for political reconciliation. The third aspect is reconstruction. In what is still one of the poorest countries on earth, where only one in three have clean drinking water, life expectancy just 43, 80% of women cannot yet read. We will help ensure through reconstruction and development that more Afghan people have an economic stake in the future.
That was Gordon Brown in the Commons on Wednesday. Julian, people haven't really paid much attention to Afghanistan until recently. Do you think we're finally waking up and realising that we may have a Northern Ireland-style commitment on our hands?
I think we do have a long commitment, and it's not clear whether it'll be a success. I think what's happening politically is a separation of Iraq and Afghanistan. They were seen, probably wrongly for a long time, as similar sort of foreign battles involving Tony Blair and the Americans, and they're really very different wars. Clearly Gordon Brown, I think David Cameron too, and maybe the Liberal Democrats have all decided Iraq is finished, may succeed, may not succeed, but Britain's role is over. Afghanistan, Britain's role is going to grow. David Cameron's been out there several times. He didn't really question much of Brown's statement today. Gordon Brown absolutely wants to win this one. I don't know if he thinks he's going to, but he's going to stick with it. And in a way, it's quite brave of him.
Polly, that's interesting that Julian's saying that there seems to be a political consensus that we're sort of in for the long haul. But do you think that Britain is taking too much of the strain in Afghanistan? I mean, I know there's some thought that perhaps the French and the Germans could be doing a bit more.
Yes, I think there's been a lot of disappointment in the European effort. I mean, the idea that the Germans won't go out at night and the Italians won't fight, and all of this has played very badly, I think, in the British press with British people. I mean, if we reach a point where it's less about fighting and more about handing over and backing up the Afghan forces, and if it's more about reconstruction, then maybe we'll manage to get a more united European effort. It's been pretty feeble up until now.
Nick Gibb, as a representative of the Conservative front bench here, do you see a sort of a consensus between the main parties on Afghanistan?
Well, it's the Tory line that we agree with Polly Toynbee on most things these days, and I agree with what she's just said on that. I think one of the big mistakes made in Iraq was we didn't focus on ensuring that the infrastructure was replaced rapidly with electricity and water, and this is what we now have to do in Afghanistan.
That's certainly true, but we shouldn't take too easily this line from Gordon Brown that we're moving on to stage two of the operation, as though stage one was always planned and it went very well. Stage two of the operation is what stage one should have been, and at the time the government said it was going to be, which is reconstruction involving Afghan troops and Afghan police forces with the British Army as a sort of backup. That's what we'd hoped to have all the way through. It didn't work. The British Army's out there fighting now. There's not much reconstruction going on. There's a bit in Kabul. There's nothing much happening in Helmand. Gordon Brown could give this idea of a structure to it. Really, he's just hoping things are going to get better there. And if we stick and we fight for a few more summers, in the end, we will manage to get some control over much of the country, or the authorities will. He may be right about that, but it's not easy.
That's
it's
a sort
very
of a
sad though, because I was there a year after the fall of Kabul, and there was a great sense of optimism. I mean, you looked sort of awestruck at the amount that had to be done. I mean, there was just nothing, no infrastructure, nothing. Places razed to the ground in an appalling state from years of civil war. And yet you saw the beginning green shoots all over the place and everything beginning to look better. And since then, it's gone backwards.
But there's one great strength Gordon Brown and all Western politicians have got, and that's Karzai running Afghanistan. He's incredibly telegenic and he's very fluent. And when he stands next to Gordon Brown, you think, goodness, there's somebody there he can deal with. We never had that in Iraq. We didn't have a clear political leader who could almost appear at press conferences. And if Karzai went, that would make it a lot harder, I think.
And he has a fantastic line in jackets, doesn't he? But now we have highbrow musical tastes on Politics Weekly. We have donned our bow ties and put out our Union Jacks as we relive the last night of the proms. Polly, please put your klaxon away. The future of the United Kingdom became a talking point this week as the political past classes took part in the Daily Telegraph's Call Yourself British campaign. David Cameron kicked off the series when he told the paper that he would do nothing to jeopardise the union. Nick Gibb, David Cameron says he won't jeopardise the union, but what about this plan to have English-only votes for MPs, Scottish MPs not allowed to vote on English matters?
Well, we're getting a little bit that way as it is. If we have an education bill going into committee, you won't see any Scottish MPs on those committees. So I think there is a sort of already building a sort of view that if you are a Scottish MP and it's an issue about a devolved matter, then they don't take part in the nitty-gritty details. But we do need to make sure that we keep the union in place. I was born, you know, in the union, under the Union Jack, and I think it would be very detrimental for people in Scotland if they went and became a Socialist Republic of Scotland under Alex Salmond, a disaster for that country.
Polly, can I just ask you where you think we are? I mean, Labour said in 1997, we will strengthen the union by devolving powers to Scotland and to Wales. Obviously, Northern Ireland, a slightly different case. Some people are saying it's done the opposite.
Well, I think Scotland's feeling rather surprisingly good at the moment, and they're rather pleased with the government they've got. And having kind of one party Labour in power was not necessarily a good
thing.
With
the Liberal Democrats, let's not forget them.
With the Liberal Democrats, of course. But I think it's rather refreshing for them to suddenly find there is, you know, a genuine alternative. But I do think that the English votes question in the Commons is really dangerous. If the Conservative pursue this, that is straight to the exit and to the end of the union. Because if you have a situation where no Scottish MP could ever be Prime Minister or a cabinet minister for a department that involved England, effectively that's the end. If you're going to say, right, Gordon Brown has no right to be Prime Minister, then of course you're going to divide up the union.
Julian, are you concerned?
I think we're probably going to watch a gradual sort of move towards further devolution. I think the idea that happened in 97, 98, that devolution was a single act, not a process, and that we would hand over a certain number of powers, and that would be the end of the constitutional issue, has been proved to be wrong. It didn't just settle the problem. There are things Scotland will want, there are things Wales will want, and they'll probably be handed over in the next few years. That's not quite the same as independence, and I don't sense that populations on either side really want to break apart, even if they talk about it. No, what there'll be is just handing over financial powers, some more legislative powers. We'll see that in the next 10, 15 years.
Now, Nick, there would have been a time when you would have sat here and I would have introduced you not as the Conservative MP, but the Conservative and Unionist MP for Bognor Regis. What's happened to the little Unionist label in the title of your party?
Well, it's been dropped in practice. I don't know whether technically and legally it's still there, but it's certainly been dropped in practice. We're not even the Conservative Party now. We tend to be called Conservatives. I am concerned about this. And it is an issue that comes up from time to time in the constituency. People feel, why are we subsidising Scottish healthcare or Scottish education? And so there is a sort of building up a kind of English nationalism, which I don't like. I have to say, I think we have to be more magnanimous about that. So I would always resist a move towards an English parliament. I feel that the pressure for independence will come from Scotland. And if the Alex Salmond view of Scottish politics persists, I think it will lead to that. And I think it will be a great tragedy.
I mean, Polly, it's interesting, isn't it, that you mentioned how well the SNP government is doing in Scotland. One of the pressures on Jackie Smith, the Home Secretary, is that the SNP government in Scotland has given that full rise to the police in Scotland, but not to the police by the UK government in England and Wales. That's quite a tricky one, isn't it?
Yep, I think there's going to be a lot of problems about that, because right across Britain, people have very confused attitudes about wanting no postcode lottery and everybody to have the same thing, and yet wanting things, more and more decisions, to be devolved down locally, whether to the regions or the nations or to their local authority. And I don't think people have yet decided in their mind what that balance should be. I mean, certainly when it comes to public sector pay, the government's in deep trouble. I mean, trying to hold down 1.9% over the next 3 years while you're seeing people in the FTSE 100 boardroom getting 37%, according to the Guardian's horrific, shocking annual survey. If you have nothing to say about what goes on at the top, you can't really hope to hold on what goes on at the bottom.
Well, that's it from this edition of Politics Weekly. Thanks to all my guests, the Shadow Education Minister Nick Gibb, the Guardian columnist Polly Toynbee, and our chief leader writer Julian Glover. Politics Weekly was produced by Francesca Panetta. I'm Nick Watt. Join us again next week for an end-of-year roundup. Till then, goodbye.
Guardian Unlimited.